This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
November 25th, 2018. In a meeting with government officials of the Islamic Republic of Iran, ambassadors of Islamic countries and participants of the 32 Conference on Islamic Unity. Practicing Islamic unity will allow Muslims to overcome all the schemes of the enemies of Islam. The Holy Prophet. He was a bright sun who shone during the time of ignorance and Jahili deception, and who illuminated the world. As the Commander of the Faithful, peace and greetings be upon him, said, "While the world was devoid of brightness and full of open deceitfulness, this is the truth of the matter. The world was saturated with the darkness of Jahiliyyah and deception during the time when the God of the world presented that light to humanity. Today, the holy body of the Holy Prophet is not with us, but God sent him with guidance and true religion. His religion and his guidance are with us. If we follow this light, and if we are among the people who are described as the ones who follow the light which is sent down with him, then the result is that it is they who will prosper." The Holy Quran, Surah 7, verse 157.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Obeying divine guidance and the light which he has sent down, this light is the Quran, as it is the book of guidance and light, and obeying this divine gift given by God through the Holy Prophet will help humanity to achieve bliss and salvation. Humanity is after bliss and salvation. From the beginning until today, the plight of humanity has been a lack of justice, mercy, and guidance. The various forms of ignorance that humanity has experienced have made life difficult for humanity. Today, humanity is in need of the same source of light. Today, too, humanity needs to accept the Holy Prophet's invitation, which is an invitation to the truth, to integrity, and to mercy. If humanity reaches such a level of intellectual maturity that it accepts the invitation of the Holy Prophet of Islam, then its maladies will be healed.
I wanna thank you
community weak. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. We are in the Unity Week. This week begins on the 12th and ends on the 17th of the Islamic month of Rabiul Awwal. It was Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, who named this period as the Unity Week to unite Sunni and Shia Muslims. The Sunnis believe that the 12th of this month is the birthday of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, while Shias maintain that the Prophet was born on the 17th of the month of Rabiul Awwal. Please stay tuned for the first part of the special series on this occasion. Everyone needs a perfect and sure role model to reach sublimity and lofty moral virtues. According to the Quranic ayahs, the best role model is the messenger of mercy, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. No doubt, following him will help us achieve true life. The Prophet of Islam was not negligent of God's remembrance even for a single moment. It is narrated that when he stood for prayer, his face would change, and there would be heard a sound from his chest and throat like that of scared people. The Prophet's wife said, "When we were speaking with the Messenger of God, as soon as the time of prayer arrived, he would change in a way as if he hadn't known us." God addresses the Prophet in ayahs 162 and 163 of Surah An'am of the Noble Quran, saying, "Say, indeed my prayer and my worship, my life and my death are for the sake of Allah, the Lord of all the worlds. He has no partner, and this I have been commanded, and I am the first of those who submit to Allah." God makes it clear that the element of the Prophet's success is that he was lenient, tolerant, and kind-hearted. He was not aggressive toward masses. In ayah 159 of Surah Al-Imran, we read, "It is by Allah's mercy that you are gentle to them, and had you been harsh and hard-hearted, surely they would have scattered from around you." Imam Ali, peace upon him, says, "The hearts of the righteous were absorbed toward him. The locks were gazed at him. God buried old grudges by him, extinguished the burning flames of enmity, brought hearts close to each other, and made people brothers of one another." Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, used to behave people in a way that their personality was respected. It is narrated that when a person came to the Prophet, he would never look down upon him and would never allow others to humiliate him either. He would give him the best part of his house. If he had a guest who had no mat to sit, he would spread his abaya for him to sit on. Famous historian Ibn Mas'ud writes, "One day a man was speaking with the Prophet, but he was shivering as the awe of the Prophet had impressed him. The Prophet noticed the matter, so he told the man, 'Take it easy, my brother. Feel at home. I am not a king.'" History bears witness that the Prophet of Islam lived the life of the lowest strata in the society. According to some narrations, he would avoid eating wheat bread as it was not accessible for most of the people at that time. Imam Sadiq, peace upon him, said, "The Messenger of God never ate wheat bread and never ate barley bread fully." Dear listeners, barley bread and dates were the Prophet's usual food. He used to darn his garment and shoes. Although he had a simple way of living, he considered wealth as necessary for society and economy. He said, "Legitimately gained wealth is so good for a righteous man." Another aspect of the Prophet's simple way of living was that he never allowed his gathering to have high and low positions. He would make his companions sit in a circle so that everyone was equal. His close companion, Abu Zar Ghifari, said, "The Prophet used to sit among his companions without any privilege, so that if a newcomer came, he would not recognize the Prophet unless he asked. Later on, he allowed us to build a platform for him from stone and mud so that he would sit on it and we would encircle him." Consulting others is one of the important orders that have been mentioned in the Quran. It is so important that God tells the Prophet in Ayah 159 of Surah Al-Imran, "And consult them in the affairs, and once you are resolved, put your trust in Allah." For sure, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, was the absolute intellect and was not in need of anyone. Yet, through consultation, he pursued two goals. First, he wanted to hold his companions in great esteem, and secondly, he taught others to shun egotism and dictatorship. At the end of this episode, we congratulate the Prophet's birthday and recite this ayah together. "Indeed, Allah and His angels bless the prophets. O you who have faith, invoke blessings on him and be fully submissive to him."
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Bring us out from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of instruments.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. The UN Human Rights Council has voted to shut down its war crimes investigations in Yemen. How can this be the case when at least 100,000 civilians have been killed in the Saudi-led onslaught on the Yemeni people?
The United Nations Human Rights Council has voted against renewing the body's mandate for investigating possible war crimes committed by the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen. Members narrowly voted to reject a motion brought by countries including the Netherlands and Canada to give UN investigators another 2 years to monitor atrocities in Yemen. It marked the first time in the Council's 15-year history that a resolution was defeated. Ahead of the vote, UN Human Rights Chief Michelle Bachelet said there was no peace in sight in Yemen and that urgent funding was needed to avert large-scale famine there. Meanwhile, the Dutch ambassador called the vote a major setback, adding that the council failed the Yemeni people and cut their lifeline to the international community. Rights activists had previously warned that Riyadh was heavily lobbying against the resolution in a blatant attempt to ensure blanket impunity for crimes and other violations of international law in Yemen. They also accused the UNHRC of bowing to Saudi pressure and putting politics before principle. Experts believe the council has lost its credibility by shutting down the investigation.
UN Human Rights Council has lost any credibility it once had, and that was marginal anyway. But by shutting down an investigation into atrocities committed in Yemen, this is something that is clear to anybody that horrendous things are happening in Yemen. And the fact that some other countries have strong-armed those council members to vote against it is just politics, but it's corruption and it's tragic for the people of Yemen.
This is not the first time Saudi Arabia has used what many call arm twisting to stop the UN from scrutinizing the Yemen war. Back in 2016, Saudi Arabia was removed from the UN's list of children's rights violators after Riyadh threatened to cut off crucial funding to the world body. The Saudi-led war on Yemen has claimed tens of thousands of lives and displaced millions, resulting in what the UN describes as the world's worst humanitarian crisis. The coalition, which is logistically and militarily supported by the West, especially the US and the UK, has repeatedly bombed schools, hospitals, and other civilian facilities during its seven-year onslaught. The United Nations has in the past been criticized for its inaction against Riyadh. But the latest move by the Human Rights Council seems like giving a green light to Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies to continue their atrocities against impoverished Yemen with impunity.
I'd like to welcome my guests to this program, Director of Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Mr. Zafar Bangash out of Toronto. And political commentator and peace activist, Brian Terrell out of Malloy, Iowa.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Thank you both for being with us. Well, let's start this off with Zafar out of Toronto. Isn't even saying that investigations will be stopped into possible war crimes ironic to begin with? I mean, when there have been so many civilians killed, shouldn't it be obvious that war crimes have been committed?
Oh, absolutely. I think the manner in which the UN Human Rights Council has acted is absolutely scandalous when it is well known and well established that at least 100,000 people have been killed in Yemen since March of 2015 when the Saudis launched their murderous assault on that poorest of countries in the Middle East. And more than a million children are suffering from cholera. The UN agencies themselves have said that the vast majority of the Yemeni people are on the verge of starvation. And for the UN Human Rights Council now to vote to end the investigation into Saudi crimes is absolutely scandalous. I think we also need to keep in mind that the Saudi regime has an atrocious record even at home. There are tens of thousands of political prisoners in Saudi Arabia. Dissidents are murdered, they are shot to death, they are executed. All kinds of other oppressions are taking place inside Saudi Arabia. But in terms of its crimes in Yemen, I think it is well established. I mean, the UN itself has said that there have been hundreds of thousands of casualties over there. The UN itself has said that there is mass starvation, that children are suffering terribly. So to stop this investigation into Saudi war crimes makes a mockery of the UN Human Rights Council and the manner in which it conducts its business.
Well, Brian, Yemen has actually just commemorated an attack on a funeral procession 5 years ago where over 100 people were killed. How can the Saudis get away with that and such an act not be considered a war crime?
Well, it is certainly that was one crime of many, and I think what it comes down to is the U.S. and other Western countries, the arms manufacturers, are making a lot of money off of this. And a investigation into the war crimes is inconvenient, you know, to those. Back a year ago, earlier this year, when it appeared that the United States, President Biden, was talking about cutting off the weapons flow to the Saudis, and the CEO of Raytheon Corporation told his stockholders, peace is not going to break out anytime soon in the Middle East, and we will continue to see this an area of continued growth. I think it's also the politics involved is a year ago, almost exactly a year ago, Saudi Arabia tried to get a seat on this very council, the Human Rights Council of the United Nations, and was defeated. But the bid to stop this investigation was led by the ambassador from Bahrain, and I've been to Bahrain, and to say that Bahrain, the Hamad monarchy in Bahrain is a government for the people of Bahrain with their welfare and interests at heart, is is really absurd. It really is. It's a Saudi proxy, and this is how the Saudis have been able to do this. They really do have the seat on this council, only it's named after the Kingdom of Bahrain.
Well, Zafar, why haven't we seen more intervention to stop the carnage by this Saudi regime in Yemen from the so-called international community again?
Well, basically, as Brian pointed out, it has a lot to do with the sale of weapons, and Saudi Arabia is the largest importer of weapons in the Middle East by far, and in fact, even in terms of weapons imports worldwide, Saudi Arabia is right there at the top. And you need to keep in mind that in weapons sales, the return on profits is enormous. And so the weapons manufacturers want to encourage more wars so that their weapons are sold, so that they can their weapons are used, so that they can sell more weapons. And so wars for them is a profitable business. And that's why we see that around the world, countries like the United States, Britain, France, other weapons manufacturers are very happy to see these wars continue, even when the Saudis are perpetrating horrific crimes. And we also need to keep in mind that these Western countries are also guilty of war crimes, just as the Zionist regime in occupied Palestine is. And you know, let's remember back in earlier this year, the International Criminal Court actually said that they have the right to investigate Israeli crimes against the Palestinians. And when the ICC chief prosecutor was changed in June, because her term ended in June and a new chief prosecutor came on board, this matter against the Zionist regime has gone silent. So we see that not only the Saudi crimes in Yemen, but the Western regimes themselves are guilty of horrendous crimes against humanity, and therefore they're not going to push for any investigation of Saudi crimes. The only time they push for any investigations is if there is a government or a ruler that does not toe the American line, then they go after such a government or particular ruler, and they try to haul that particular ruler before the International Criminal Court. So in this case, we see that there are definitely double standards being applied. I don't think that there is any doubt in the minds of anybody that Saudi Arabia is a gross violator of human rights. It has committed war crimes in Yemen. But unfortunately, there are countries around the world, Western countries, that are quite happy supplying it weapons, and they want to shield the Saudi regime from any criticism or any investigation that would haul these criminals or bring these criminals to justice.
Ryan, what do you make of what Zafar just said? So if the case is so that these many of these Western governments are also involved in war crimes, whether in Yemen or other places, and continue to basically shield Saudi Arabia. So, I mean, isn't the whole concept then of a United Nations Human Rights Council, and even perhaps the United Nations itself, when these countries have so much power on a committee like that, or in the United Nations itself, like the Security Council, I mean, at the end of the day, what does it really do if these countries are also complicit?
Yeah, well, this instance calls to mind just a couple of years ago, the International Criminal Court was investigating the United States for war crimes in Afghanistan, and the United States responded by putting sanctions against the investigators. So yeah, the Dutch ambassador has said, rightly, that the council has failed the people of Yemen, and in the most immediate sense, that's true, where you have 18 million people facing starvation in the very near term. But in the broader sense, this has failed the people of the world, and it's you know, as has been mentioned, this UN Human Rights Council has had very little credibility, but what credibility it has really, it is lost, and it's tragic for people who are looking for the people of the world, who are looking for ways that to solve problems with through diplomacy, but of course diplomacy doesn't bring in a lot of cash for the arms manufacturers, who really are more than our governments, more than our kingdoms and legislators, and more than the United Nations, setting policy and setting the course of the world.
Sapphire, do you think that if Washington ordered Riyadh to stop the war today, that it could end today?
Oh, absolutely. The United States exercises enormous influence for a number of reasons. As you know, you mentioned in your earlier question that it has a very, very large say in the UN Security Council. The UN Security Council basically is a body in which five permanent members dictate to the rest of the world. And so they can get away literally with crimes and murder, and nobody can touch them. If, for instance, the United States wanted to stop this horrendous war in Yemen and stop these war crimes from being committed in Yemen, it could do so, because the United States is supporting the Saudi regime. It is providing intelligence information. It is, in fact, identifying targets for the Saudis to hit, although the Saudis are so incompetent that they often fail to hit military targets, and they target civilian populations, schools, hospitals, grain depots, and so on. The list is endless. I mean, the number of crimes that the Saudis have perpetrated in Yemen is absolutely horrendous. It is well known. It is well documented. The only people that are basically shying away from it is the UN Human Rights Council, under pressure from the Western regimes, because the Western regimes themselves are complicit in these crimes. We need to remember that since 9/11, the United States and its allies have murdered an estimated 32 million people worldwide. You can take Afghanistan and Iraq and Yemen and Libya and Syria, Lebanon, Somalia, Mali at the present time. In all of these countries, horrendous crimes are being perpetrated by the Western regimes. And this is well documented. It's not something, there's an Australian professor who did the analysis, and he came up with the figure of 32 million, largely civilians, killed over the last 20 years. So what we are witnessing is worldwide, all of these regimes are perpetrating these horrific crimes. And so in that sense, they are complicit in the Saudi crimes in Yemen as well. And that is why the U.S., although it has the power and the authority to stop these crimes, it doesn't want to do so, as we mentioned earlier, because if the war in Yemen ended, then who's going to be selling weapons to Saudi Arabia? The Saudis would not need any more weapons. And so it has to do with selling weapons. It has to do with Saudi Arabia serving as a cash cow. And it has to do with keeping that entire Middle East region unstable, so that the Zionist regime can continue to maintain its hegemony, and the people of the region, that is the Middle East, continue to pay a very, very heavy price.
You just made interesting points, Zafar and Bryant. So if it is the case, as Zafar has said, that obviously Washington could make this war in, so is it in the U.S.'s strategic interest to keep this war going? I mean, Zafar just talked about, and you also mentioned about, as far as selling arms. But at the end of the day, does it help the United States strategically to continue this war against Yemen?
No, it doesn't help the people of the United States. It doesn't help what really our U.S. interests. What it helps is the arms industry, and it's the people of the United States in various ways, not as dramatically immediately as the people of Yemen. But we're in a country with a decaying infrastructure. We are the industrialized country with the most inept healthcare, education system. Things are falling apart here because of the same thing. This is not helping the United States. It's helping the corporations that own the politicians. So no, it's not in anyone's interest. And I think the United States really ought to, at this point, with the challenge of climate change, ought to be thinking about other options rather than using our own shale oil that was considered too dirty to process only a few years ago, or trying to control the oil flow out of the Middle East. We need to be finding alternatives, and that would be to the interests of the United States, of its people, but it would be very hard on the arms manufacturers and the U.S.-based petroleum industry.
Well, Zafar, we have seen the Yemenis be resilient in fighting back and trying to resist the Saudi-led onslaught. Do you think that the more the Yemenis feel that injustice is being waged against them by the Saudis and their supporters, the more defiant the Yemenis have become?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, the people of Yemen have demonstrated over the last 6.5 years or so that they will not tolerate foreign aggression. They have shown remarkable resilience despite the fact that they are extremely poor. They have paid a very heavy price, but they are now hitting back. And I think this is something that we need to look at in the broader context, in the sense that when people are under oppression, when people are getting killed, they are being bombed, crimes are being committed against them, they are left with absolutely no choice but to fight back. And I think in case of Yemen, and we saw earlier in Afghanistan as well, where the people fought against the U.S. and its allies for 20 years, ultimately driving the U.S. out of Afghanistan, although it cost the U.S. $2.26 trillion, and all of that money has gone down the drain. But in case of Yemen, the Yemenis are putting up a very stiff resistance, and they're also targeting vital military installations inside Saudi Arabia. And I think that the time is getting closer when the Yemenis would be able to get rid of this Saudi aggression, to defeat the Saudi aggressors completely, and perhaps even as a bonus to get rid of the ruling corrupt Saudi family, because they have been a bane not only for the people of Saudi Arabia, but virtually the entire Muslim world. And so that day, we hope, is sooner rather than later, but definitely we salute the Yemeni people for their courageous resistance in the face of enormous odds.
On that note, I'd like to thank both of you for being with us on the Spotlight, the Director, Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought, Zafar Bangash, out of Toronto, and political commentator and peace activist Brian Terrell out of Molloy, Iowa. And as always, we appreciate you being with us on another Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashimi, signing out for myself and other crew right here in Tehran.
A dizzying amount of money is already pouring into the battles for the House and the Senate more than a year before the 2022 elections. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Shane Goldmacher Ryder. This article is published under the heading Money Floods the Race for Control of Congress More Than a Year Early. Stay tuned for more. A dizzying amount of money is already pouring into the battles for the House and the Senate more than a year before the 2022 elections. as Republicans are bullish on their chances to take over both chambers in the first midterm election under President Joe Biden, given the narrow margins keeping Democrats in power. The two parties' main war chest for the House total a combined $128 million, more than double the sum at this point in the 2020 cycle and far surpassing every other previous one. Top House members are now raising $1 million or more per quarter, and more than two dozen senators and Senate candidates topped that threshold. Candidate after candidate and the parties themselves are posting record-breaking sums, even as the shapes of most House districts nationwide remain in flux because of delays in a once-a-decade redrawing of boundaries. In Georgia, Senator Raphael Warnock, a Democrat, raised more than $100,000 per day in the past 3 months for a $9.5 million haul. But his leading Republican rival, Herschel Walker, the former football player who was urged to run by former President Donald Trump, raised $3.7 million in a little more than a month, setting up a potentially bruising and expensive contest in that key state. Politicians in both parties are furiously racing to expand their online donor bases while simultaneously courting big checks from wealthy benefactors. At a Senate Republican retreat for big donors in Palm Beach, Florida this past week, Trump's presence was a reminder of his continued perch at the center of the Republican Party, both in helping lure donations and in derailing whatever messaging that party operatives have designed. The donor community is waking up to the fact that the Republican Party has a historic opportunity in 2022, in spite of Trump continuing to talk about 2020, said Scott Reed, a longtime Republican strategist. Money alone is rarely decisive in political races, especially when both parties are flush with cash. But the glut of political funding detailed in Federal Election Commission reports filed recently by House and Senate candidates and announced by the parties shows the growing stakes of U.S. elections, where a single flip Senate seat can shift trillions of dollars in federal spending. The U.S. increasingly polarized electorate has been hyper-engaged in politics since the Trump era began, and the ease of channeling that energy into donations online is remarking how campaigns are funded. The online donation clearing houses for the two parties, Act Blue and WinRed, processed a combined total of more than $450 million in the third quarter. The avalanche of cash could expand the 2022 political battlefield and result in an unrelenting wave of advertising aimed at Americans who live in swing districts and states. The ad wars have, in fact, already begun. Democratic and Republican-linked groups are spending millions of dollars to shape public opinion on the spending package currently being debated in Congress. Among them is one Biden-aligned nonprofit group, Building Back Together, which said it had spent nearly $15 million on television ads in more than two dozen House districts and key states since July. This past week, a Republican-aligned nonprofit group, One Nation, announced that it was beginning a $10 million ad campaign, urging three Democratic senators up for re-election in 2022. In Nevada, Arizona, and New Hampshire to oppose the spending package. All told, more than $70 million has been spent since September 1st on television ads related to the Biden legislative agenda, according to Item Pact, a media tracking firm. historically, the party out of power has done well in a new president's first midterm election, and Republicans see rising inflation, missteps in Afghanistan, and a softening in Biden's approval rating as reasons for a sunny 2022 outlook. Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, referring to the Democrats' narrow majority in that chamber, said, "We will have to really screw up to lose the House." He said that recapturing the Senate, which is a split even between 50 Republicans and 50 members of the Democratic caucus, would depend on recruiting more top-tier Republicans such as Governor Chris Sununu of New Hampshire. At the donor retreat in Florida, Graham said there was a sense of optimism that was as high as I have seen it. In the House, the path to the majority is widely expected to be determined by suburban voters who swung sharply toward the Democratic Party during the Trump administration. Jess Ferguson, a Democratic strategist who has worked on House campaigns, noted that the central role of suburban terrain, the battlegrounds were more rural 50 years ago, had driven up the cost of campaigning. Buying gas to reach suburban votes requires advertising in pricier urban television markets. The upside is the Democratic coalition is built around suburbs, Ferguson said, adding the downside is the resources to turn in Philadelphia and Chicago and LA and Miami. National Republican Congressional Committee began this year with roughly $18 million less on hand than its Democratic counterpart, but entered October with roughly $2 million more as the small digital contributions have accelerated for Republicans. Each group has raised well over $100 million this year. Representative Tom Emmer, the chairman of the Republican Congressional Committee, noted in a call with reporters that in the 2020 cycle, his party committee had not reached the $100 million threshold until February, 5 months later. Both the Senate and House Republican campaign committees have leaned on hardball and sometimes deceptive tactics to boost their bottom lines, such as pre-checking boxes that automatically enroll donors in recurring monthly contributions and aggressively fostering guilt trips in supporters and questioning their allegiances. "You're a traitor," began one such House GOP text this past week. "You abandoned Trump." The text gave a false deadline of 17 minutes to donate. It reads, "This is your final chance to prove your loyalty or be branded a deserter." The House GOP committee, which declined to comment on its tactics, said it had raised nearly 44% of its funds last quarter online. Democrats have owned online fundraising, and that is no longer true, said former Representative Tom Davis, who previously led the House Republican campaign arm. "Republicans now are the ones who are obsessed and aroused. People voted for Biden to get Trump out of their living rooms, but they didn't vote for all his policies," unquote. Most Republican strategists hope to keep the focus on Democrats, knowing voters typically want to put a check on those in power. But Trump's continued insistence on making his false claims that the 2020 election was stolen a central rallying cry for the GOP. "If we don't solve the presidential election fraud of 2020, Trump warned in a statement recently, adding, "Republicans will not be voting in 2020 or 24 is a complicating factor. If it's a referendum on Biden's policies, we will do very well," Graham said of the 2022 midterms, adding, "If it's looking back, if it's a grievance campaign, then we could be in trouble." Emmer tried to distance himself from Trump's remarks, saying He is a private citizen, and he, of course, is entitled to own opinion. Still, Emmer added that he was honored that the former president would headline the committee's fall fundraising dinner. He said he remains the biggest draw in our party. Congressional leaders are both leading party fundraisers. Representative Kevin McCarthy of California, the Republican minority leader, and his top deputy representative, Steve Scalise of Louisiana, have transferred a combined total of nearly $30 million to their party committees this year, party officials said. Scalise's top donations since July included $105,000 from the PAC of Koch Industries, $125,000 from H. Fisk Johnson, the chief executive of SC Johnson & Son, and $66,300 from John W. Childs, the private equity magnate. Whether this is the final term of House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, who is 81, is widely discussed in Washington, but the San Francisco Democrat remains a prolific fundraiser. Donors to her political accounts in recent months include Haim Saban, the media investor, Hamilton James, a top Blackstone executive, Gridlon Santemeyer, the Gargill heiress, and Jeffrey Katzberg, the Hollywood producer. Senator Chuck Schumer, the majority leader, raised heavily both for his own 2022 re-election bid in New York and to maintain the Democratic majority.